It's the Taylor Report, and our guest is Zafar Bengash. No one is better qualified than Zafar Bengash to talk about all the matters that we've been trying to cover with the Gaza, the bombing of Gaza, my goodness, the Red Sea crisis, Syria. You just throw a dart in the West Asia, where there are matters we have to ask about. And as I say, nobody better qualified than Zafar Bengash. Thank you for joining us, Zafar.
My great pleasure, Phil. Thank you.
And I think the program owes it to you to say that you, this a matter of Pakistan now is right in the center of our discussions about the growing war danger and who's going to fight who over what. But I know that the last time we spoke to you, the Democratic leader of the country, Mr. Khan, Imran Khan, was going through a quite painful ordeal. And he's obviously a major player. And I think we'd like to ask you to update us. What is his current status? What's the status of democracy, I suppose, the prospects of democracy in Pakistan? And of course, his views of the matter in the involving Gaza and Israel.
Well, Imran Khan, poor guy, is still in prison. In fact, he faces about 180 charges against him. All of them, you know, they're all bogus, totally bogus. There is no merit to them. But since it's the military that is calling the shots, they don't want him to contest the election. So they have basically disqualified him from contesting the elections. They have also they have not exactly disqualified his party, but by denying his party a symbol, every party in Pakistan has a, you know, electoral symbol, because more than 50% of the population is illiterate. So they go by whatever the party symbol is, they would put their thumb impression or whatever on it. So they have denied, and Imran Khan's party's symbol was the cricket bat, because he was a cricket star. So that is the symbol that he had. They have taken that away from him. So his candidates now have to contest the elections as independents. So the problem with that is that every candidate gets a different symbol. So, I mean, just imagine, I mean, this is a nightmare, because, you know, you would have already there are about 150 or 160 political parties. It's a zoo, you know, and then you have thousands of candidates, including independents. So if each political party has its own symbol, but the independent candidates have to get their own separate symbol. So even though they may be members of Imran Khan's party, but since they are running as independent candidates, so they get a separate symbol. And it's deliberately done in order to confuse the people, because the army essentially wants to bring about or put in place the former Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif, who's thoroughly corrupt. He's a thief. He's sort of, you know, in the past also, he messed up the country. But the army wants to bring him back because they have made a deal. And so they want to keep Imran Khan out, and they want to bring him in. And it's a total mess. I mean, in fact, even today, there was a virtual rally that Imran Khan's party organized on the internet. And of course, throughout the country, the government basically pulled the plug and blocked the internet and everything, so that people couldn't participate in that thing. So these kinds of dirty tricks they are doing. And, you know, unfortunately, the future doesn't look terribly good for Pakistan.
Yeah. It's so galling to hear that story. How do you take a party's symbol away from it? With a straight face, what judge could write that out? What's the basis? How do they explain themselves?
Well, you see, unfortunately, the judges and the courts are also completely controlled by the military. So the army essentially dictates to the judges what verdict they have to give out and when. So if, let's say, there is a particular case in which they cannot convict Imran Khan of anything, then the court simply reserves the judgment. They say, we are reserving the judgment and we'll announce it at a future date. And then they put it in cold storage and they just walk away from it. So although he would be not guilty of that particular allegation, but he's not absolved either because the judge has gone on leave. And so he continues to languish in prison. In addition, even when his trial is held, he is not brought to court. The trial is held in the prison where he is being held. And the excuse that the army and the, you know, these trial courts, etc., give is that, well, his life is in danger. That's why we cannot bring him out. What they are really trying to do is, or they are doing, is to keep him out of the public eye so that the people would forget him. But luckily, that's not the case. I mean, his party's popularity has shot up. It's survey after survey indicate that he enjoys something like 85 to 90% of the support in the country among the masses.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why they don't want him to come out. They don't want people to see him. So they even set up a court inside the prison against the law. But, you know, that's how things are working, and unfortunately, in Pakistan.
When is it a scheduled election now, 2024? And are what will they do? Will they'll try to run as independents, his supporters?
Yes, of course. The elections are due on February the 8th. So they are in basically a couple of weeks' time. And his party candidates, and I also need to add this, that when his party candidates went to register and submit their papers, what is referred to as their nomination papers, in many instances, the police and army personnel in plain clothes just snatched their papers, tore them apart and threw them away. I mean, this kind of dirty things they have been doing.
Amazing.
And still his party candidates, of course, you know, managed to then refill their forms and come with in large numbers, had them submitted. So each and every candidate in his party has to run as an independent candidate. And even now, those candidates are being kidnapped, they are threatened, their families are kidnapped, and all kinds of, you know, dirty things are being done, unfortunately.
It really makes an extraordinary situation with them now becoming a player. And I believe over the years, we've talked to you about this phenomenon that the Americans, and certainly when they were attempting to rule or militarily dominate Afghanistan, they were getting clandestine help from the Pakistani military. And and in the years past, too, they have used ethnic minorities, I use that expression, against neighbors, but like the Islamic Republic. And we seem to be having one now, which probably doesn't surprise you. I mean, that for some reason, the people, I guess it's pronounced Baluchistan, are beginning to act as do the Kurds in another region as a sort of a vehicle for terrorist activity. And now we had this explosion. Iran struck them. Now a week later, I guess Pakistan struck back. Actually, they're both are strikes against the Baluchis.
That is correct. Yes.
And for based on, you know, our starting points, that the army basically runs Pakistan. But what a very peculiar political phenomenon that army is. They seem to not just run interested in their own country. They seem to be interested in neighbors. And I guess the first question really outsiders ask is, well, is this going to become a really bad relations with Iran? Because actually, so far, there doesn't appear to be anything more than a just exchange of fire. What's all that about?
Well, I think, first of all, let us understand that these people of Balochistan, especially on the Pakistani side, are extremely oppressed. It's a very tribalistic society in Balochistan. It's not heavily populated, but in terms of its area as well as natural resources, it is the richest province in Pakistan. And yet all of its riches, mineral resources, are not for the benefit of the people of Balochistan. They are used by other provinces, especially the Punjab province, which is the largest and dominant, most populous province. And the army is primarily from there. So they are basically exploiting the Balochis. As we speak, there are about several hundred Balochis who have been encamped outside the Islamabad Press Club since December the 20th. And this includes young women, elderly women, men, etc. And their demand of the government is that, you know, there are literally thousands of young Balochis that have simply disappeared. And the army, of course, has picked them up, made them disappear. Some of them, sometimes, occasionally, their bullet-riddled bodies would be thrown on the roadside. But the rest of them have all disappeared. And these people that are protesting in Islamabad, they say, we have a simple demand. Please tell us whether our loved ones are alive or dead. And they don't get any answer. The government doesn't want to engage with them. They say, well, those people are terrorists. So these protesters doing the sit-in, they say, if they are terrorists, please charge them with the crime, put them on trial so that they can either defend themselves or you can convict them and then put them in jail. Why did you make them disappear? They've disappeared for years and years and they don't know anything about them. So that's one dimension of it. The other is that on the Iran side of Balochistan, there are various groups that are on the payroll of the United States and Israel. They are financing them. And there's a particular group called Jaish al-Adl, which means the army of justice. And these people are they've escaped from Iran and they are on the Pakistani side of Balochistan. And from there, they carry out terrorist activities in Iran's Balochistan province. They have killed literally hundreds of, you know, Iran's revolutionary guards, policemen, other people. They kill them, they attack them, they kill them, etc. But this recent sort of spat between Iran and Pakistan actually is the result of, you know, on January the 3rd, there were two suicide bombings in a place in Iran called Kirman. And this was the fourth anniversary of assassination of Iran's top general, General Qasem Soleimani, who was killed by, you know, during Donald Trump's presidency by the Americans. And the people were, literally tens of thousands of people were going to his gravesite to sort of, you know, to commemorate his anniversary. And these two terrorists who blew themselves up, they killed 84 people, innocent people, and about 150 or 160 were badly injured. And a day later, this terrorist group, ISIS, claimed responsibility. And of course, ISIS is also financed by the US. And Iran's intelligence agencies were able to figure out that not only ISIS, but also this Jaish al-Adl were involved in these terrorist activities. Because Kirman, the city, is fairly close to Iran's border with Pakistan in Balochistan. And so they were able to put this together. And in fact, the government of Iran told the Pakistani government that either you deal with these terrorists or we will have to take action. But of course, you know, the Pakistani army doesn't want to do that because they are closely aligned with the Americans. So they would allow American-sponsored terrorists in Pakistan to operate. And even, I mean, the funny thing is that America has declared this group, Jaish al-Adl, as a terrorist organization, just as they have declared ISIS as a terrorist organization, but they still finance them. They still provide them logistical support. So anyway, when Pakistan didn't do anything about these terrorists, so Iran was forced to take action. And in particular, this happened on the night of January the 15th, when Iran's Revolutionary Guards discovered that this group was about to launch another attack inside Iran, and they had only about 30 minutes to make a decision. So they decided to strike, and that's what took place. So they struck these terrorists, and of course, you know, Pakistan said, well, you know, this is terrible, you have violated our sovereignty, etc. And there was a counter-strike from Pakistan after about a couple of days. But Iran did not want to escalate this matter. And Iran always said, even after their strike, they said, our attack or our operation is not against Pakistan or its people. We have hit people that are our citizens who are involved in terrorist activities. And they have killed so many of our people. And in particular, these terrorist acts in Kerman on January the 3rd. So we have to take action against them. And so when Pakistan sort of launched an attack, it seems to me that they basically, between Iran and Pakistan, they sort of agreed that Pakistan would carry out an attack in an area where no Iranian citizen was living, because there are some Balochis from Pakistani side who are also in Iran. And so they attacked that area, and then immediately Pakistan said that we don't want to escalate, and so the two countries have sort of, you know, now reduced the tension. But I think that's not the end of the story. The reason is that Iran's fundamental policy is that it wants to see the end of American presence in the region, because they see America as the source of trouble and problems in the entire region.
Yes.
Whereas the Pakistani military that basically runs Pakistan, they want to have the Americans in there. They want to bring Americans in. They want to give them military bases. And that was the reason why they had to overthrow Imran Khan, because he had refused to give military bases to America. So there is that fundamental difference of opinion between Iran's policy and Pakistan's policy. And I fear that in the future, this will lead to further trouble and problems.
I'm really glad to... I'm not happy with what might happen, but I'm really glad you speak candidly about it, because there seemed a kind of a curious amongst the people who comment on these things, a kind of almost cynical analysis saying, well, each fired on the others, you know, a portion of the same community on either side of the border, and maybe it was like in tandem or something. But as you point out, with the American role, this is not a joke. This is a very dangerous situation. On that point, it does strike me that the Islamic Republic, while it is not being adventurous, a lot of, you know, because with the crisis in Gaza, there's a lot of hue and cry of everybody should go and fight. But when you have armies under your responsibility, you take some care with how you do things. But it strikes me that Americans are the aggressors in all of these situations we're talking about. And we grow, the people grow used to the idea that the U.S. will strike inside Syria. They're in there, of course, with an army. And they'll strike wherever they feel like in Iraq. They will lead the fight and encourage hostilities in Lebanon. So it's, what Iran seems to be doing is taking a stiffer posture. And I want to ask you, for example, they struck inside Syria. I haven't heard anybody say, by the way, what Syrians said about that. They struck at Syria, and they struck at northern Iraq, which the Americans treated as an independent country, a Kurdish country. So can you talk about Iran's, why they're doing this in those two countries?
Yes. I'm glad you raised this question. As far as the Syrian situation is concerned, obviously the Syrians welcomed that strike because the strike was against the terrorists, the ISIS terrorists, who are in Idlib province, which is not under Syrian government control. So Iran basically struck these terrorists, ISIS terrorists, and so the Syrian government was very happy about it. Also, in Syria, Israel has been carrying out attacks against Iran's revolutionary guards that are serving as advisors to the Syrian military. So, for instance, there was a revolutionary guards general who was hit by a Syrian, an Israeli missile on December the 15th. He was assassinated. Then last night, that is Saturday night, Israel again fired missiles at Syria in Damascus, and five revolutionary guards who were sort of, some of them were senior, members, not of general rank, but still senior officials. They were killed again in this strike, and Iran has said that we will retaliate. So now let me link this with what Iran did in northern Iraq, which is the city that they targeted is called Erbil, which is the capital city of Kurdistan, which is a sort of semi-autonomous region in Iraq. Now, there, Iran struck a Mossad base. Mossad were involved in there. In fact, there is a Mossad agent named Ilan Nisim. He was actually operating in that area for the last 20 years. And he was coordinating terrorist activities against the Islamic Republic of Iran, sending people in there, launching them from Iraqi Kurdistan because this is they have a common border. So he was killed in that strike in Erbil, as well as four of his other operatives, and a Kurdish oil tycoon who was smuggling oil to Israel from Iraqi Kurdistan. And he was also, of course, recruiting for Mossad over there. And another point to note is that the house that was being used by Mossad actually belonged to this Kurdish tycoon. And the house was built very close to the U.S. consulate in Erbil. And they deliberately did it because they thought that if it's close to the U.S. consulate, if, let's say, Iran were to fire missiles, and if a missile was sort of strayed from its particular target, it could hit the U.S. consulate, and that would obviously get America involved directly. Yes. But Iran has very precise weapons and very precise missiles, and they hit the target precisely, and they killed this Mossad operative as well as four of his subordinates, this Kurdish, crook who's illegally selling Iraqi oil to the Israelis, so they have been wiped out. So basically, Mossad operations in Kurdistan have been wiped out completely now.
And by the way, I'm really glad you stressed that point. I noticed that the New York Times confirmed at one point that it was that there is a Mossad, or had been a Mossad base there. And John Bolton, former big shot under Trump, also said it. But meanwhile, they started another story that, oh, no, it's not there. But there doesn't seem to be any doubt at all, does there?
No, not at all. I think this has been known for at least 20 years after, Saddam Hussein's regime was overthrown in 2003. Even prior to that, actually, Mossad used to have close links with the Kurds, and they were instigating the Kurds. They were basically providing them, they're publishing their material, propaganda material, etc., and even financing them. So after Saddam's overthrow, the Kurds basically declared their autonomous region, and they're running it on their own because they have their own president, their own prime minister, their own parliament, etc. So they are basically they have de facto independence.
Yeah.
And, it was therefore easier for Mossad and the U.S. to operate from there and to cause trouble for the Islamic Republic or anybody else like Syria, whatever, because they lie on both sides of the border. So that was one of their bases that has now been wiped out.
I really wish people could follow these things as closely as you are outlining. And by the way, we're speaking to Zafar Benghazi. You can look him up and Google him faster than I can tell you how to find him. And just to underline that, we once had Scott Taylor, the former military man who writes on military matters. He said he visited the region. And I remember he said the most striking thing you have to understand is that they say it's Iraq. And that at one time, you remember, Canada had forces there, and they always said Iraq. He said they were all in the Kurdish area. And if you're in the Kurdish area, you do not see Iraqi flags. There are none. All you see are the Kurdish flag. And, of course, this is part of the nightmare that Iraqis inherited after the U.S. assault. And about that, there's got to be a political crisis in Iraq because the leaders have all said to the Americans, we want you to go. And the Americans at the moment are saying we're sending more people.
Exactly. I mean, the Iraqi government has repeatedly demanded that the Americans must leave. In fact, soon after General Qasem Soleimani was assassinated 4 years ago, the Iraqi parliament passed a resolution demanding that the American forces must be pulled out or removed from Iraq. In fact, a few days ago, the Iraqi prime minister was in Davos, Switzerland, for the World Economic Forum. He again publicly and in front of the international media, he made this demand that we want America to get its forces out of Iraq. We don't want them in our country. And America is saying, no, we are there to train your forces. And he said, well, we don't need your training. You just leave our country. But obviously, they're not strong enough to drive American forces out of there. But what is happening is that American forces are now being targeted in Iraq with drones, with other kinds of attacks, etc. And so a situation perhaps would emerge whereby it would be very difficult for the Americans to maintain their forces over there. As you mentioned, American forces are also present in Syria illegally. There is absolutely no justification for them. The Syrian government has not given them permission, and yet they are over there and they say, well, we are here because we want to...
It's self-defense, right?
Yeah, exactly.
America has a permanent base in Syria to defend America.
Yeah, exactly. And also they make this excuse that, well, we are here to fight these ISIS terrorists whom they're financing, they're providing weapons, they're providing logistical support, and yet they say, well, we are here because we want to fight them.
Yeah, the emperor has no clothes. I saw an item, and I don't know if this is true, if you saw it, but... after this really, again, the Israeli conduct is becoming quite irrational, you might say. Certainly, it's, I guess, with U.S. prompting, but this thing of murdering people in Lebanon, assassinating, I should say, and also in Syria, the report is that the Russians have made a decision and are presently flying now along the Golan border, along the demarcation line, which they had not been doing. Are you hearing this? And would you expect that Syria and Russia are sort of also becoming more prepared for what might become a larger fight?
Yeah. Well, so far I haven't seen these reports, but what I have seen and read is that about a week ago, the Russians agreed to a proposal that they would enter into a strategic agreement with Iran. And so this is a major development because Iran had suggested this quite a while ago, and even on December the 7th, when Iran's president, Raisi, went to Moscow, he spoke to Putin about this and said that we need to finalize this agreement. But about a week ago or so, the Russian defense minister called his counterpart in Iran and said that we are now ready to enter into this agreement, and we will sign it as soon as the two presidents can meet, etc. So with respect to Syria, obviously, Russian presence is over there, but I would say that so far, Russia has not taken the steps that are expected of it, in the sense that when Israeli planes come to bomb Damascus, Russia has not intercepted them.
Yes.
Because Russia has S-400 anti-aircraft missiles over there, but they have not been made operational or hit Israeli planes. And so Israel has been able to carry out these terrorist attacks in Syria because Russia has not taken any steps in this regard. But if this agreement between Iran and Russia is finalized, then I think what you said earlier, that Russian planes might begin to fly over the Israeli illegally occupied Golan Heights, that might become a reality. But I just want to add one more point, and that is that what Israel has been doing, assassinating Palestinian leaders in Beirut and other places, and targeting Damascus and assassinating Iranian Revolutionary Guards commanders, etc. This basically reflects Israel's desperation, because in Gaza, they have not been able to defeat Hamas militarily. Hamas is still operational. It is still able to inflict damage on the Israeli army. To give you an example, in fact, Israel has what is referred to as the Golani Brigade. This is their elite force that goes into, any battle, and they are very gung-ho. And yet, the Hamas fighters and Islamic Jihad fighters inflicted so much damage on the Golani Brigade that it had to be pulled out of Gaza because they could no longer sustain their operations over there.
Yes.
Of course, Israeli frustration is also manifested by the fact that they keep on bombing Palestinian civilians in Gaza who are totally defenseless. They have destroyed almost all the hospitals, schools, all the civil infrastructure. They have not left anything intact.
The university was completely destroyed. It was freestanding a university.
Yeah.
In Gaza, and I guess they emptied out the people and blew it up.
Exactly. But it's not just...
As you say, there's some kind of irrational insecurity from the mighty super-armed Israel.
Yes. And of course, the other factor also is that although Israeli military personnel or leaders, etc., want to end this war because Israel has not achieved its objectives, and they can never achieve their objectives militarily. But Netanyahu refuses to accept or allow for a ceasefire, simply because the moment there is a ceasefire, Netanyahu would be arrested. He would be thrown in jail because he already faces criminal charges, and the military establishment and people in Israel blame him for what happened on October the 7th when Hamas was able to carry out its
rightly terrorism. So, if you're in charge of defense, you
exactly.
should be removed. If you failed, the first thing to do is get rid of the people who don't know what they're doing.
Exactly. So that's the situation, and that's why, out of frustration, they are killing more and more Palestinian civilians. The death toll has far exceeded 25,000 in Gaza.
Yes.
And the overwhelming majority of the people are desperately short of food and water, and particularly medicines. I can tell you, UNICEF actually published a report on December the 21st, and they said that more than 1,000 Palestinian children have had to amputate, or their limbs had to be amputated without anesthesia. Can you imagine the pain that those children must have suffered? It's just horrible. Absolutely horrible, because there is no anesthesia. And so, you know, they have to endure that terrible, terrible pain. The children are held on all sides by, you know, people so that the surgeons can cut their limbs. I mean, it's just absolutely,
The principal evidence is coming from credible third parties whose only job is to try to keep people fed with water and with medicine. And it is them. It's not a partisan organization that's been bringing these facts. And here we are with it's going on, and the International Criminal Court is looking at the case while the bombs are falling.
Yeah, International Court of Justice.
Political circumstance.
Yeah, International Court of Justice, yeah, because South Africa brought the case there to the International Court of Justice because it's state-to-state sort of relationship or state-to-state issue. But if the International Court of Justice, and there is a strong indication that they would find Israel guilty of genocide, because all of the you know, requirements have been established and fulfilled, which means intent, that Israeli leaders have issued statements that they will carry out the genocide. They are carrying out the genocide, and they are killing civilians, even those civilians that Israel tells them, okay, you move from point A to point B, and you have to take this route. And when the people take that route, the Israeli planes come and bomb them right over there. So they are sort of, you know, even killing them in the areas that Israel has designated for them. So all of these parameters have been established at the International Court of Justice. And I must say, South African lawyers made an excellent case. They presented their arguments in a very systematic and methodical manner. And one hopes that the International Court of Justice would be able to deliver the verdict that they are guilty of genocide. And then, of course, that will then open the way for the case being taken to the International Criminal Court. And then the Israeli leaders, both military and political, can then be charged for war crimes.
Yeah, this has all happened in a matter of 3 months. It's phenomenal. Yes. And with the pace, it's like watching an avalanche. We're speaking to Zafar Bengash. I have to ask you, Zafar, an area that is not well understood is the Red Sea issue with, they keep saying Houthi. Can we say Yemen, or do we have to say Houthi?
we can say Yemen, and the actual title is Ansarullah. Just as you have Hezbollah in Lebanon, this is Ansarullah in Yemen.
Except they really command almost all the territory of what is called Yemen, right?
Correct, yes. Except for the south, a little portion in the south, the rest of the country is under their control. And for more than 8 years, they've been battling the Saudis and the Emiratis, and who are backed by the Americans, the British, and the French, etc. And of course, after 8 years of bloodletting, the Saudis realized that they cannot win. So last October, they, through the UN mediated efforts, they agreed to a ceasefire with Ansarullah. And now, after this Israeli attack on Gaza, Ansarullah have basically become active in the Red Sea, particularly around Bab al-Mandab, and they've said that any ship that belongs to Israel, or any ship that is taking any goods to Israel, we will not allow them to pass here because they are targeting the Palestinians in Gaza. And unless and until Israel agrees to a ceasefire, we will not let their ships go through. And they've already, you know, taken...
It's phenomenal.
And absolutely.
And their stock has very high, apparently, throughout the Arab world, the Ummah. I was wondering, what is Saudi? The Saudis are in talks for an agreement, but I haven't seen them pull out of the agreement. I was afraid they were going to take this as an excuse to pull out.
No, because the Saudis really want to bring that war to an end because they have suffered tremendous losses and they simply cannot sustain them anymore. Now, I also want to add that, you know, America set up an armada and brought a number of countries, about 10, 11 countries, in which, unfortunately, Canada is also involved. And they sort of, you know, are saying that, well, we are going to make sure that international shipping is not affected. And the Ansarullah have said that any ships that are not going to Israel, we will not bother. They can go through freely. We will provide them safe passage. But any ship that is going to Israel, we will not allow, just because Israel is not allowing any food or medicines to go to the people of Gaza. So this is a fair sort of, you know, position that they have taken. And they've also told the Americans that if you interfere, because American and British naval forces have fired missiles at Ansarullah positions in Yemen, and they have hit back at American ships and, you know, British ships. They have not sunk them, but they have fought back.
So the crisis is actually that they were going to solve is, of course, getting worse. And if you're in commercial shipping, you keep your ships out of the area because of the stupid behavior of UK, US, and Canada, right?
Exactly. And in fact, all of the insurance companies have said that they are not going to insure any ships that are passing through the Red Sea. So now ships have to take the longer route around Africa, which takes 25 to 30 days more than what they used to take if they went through the Red Sea. So this has the, you know, insurance costs have skyrocketed, and no ships are going through the Red Sea because of this blockade that Ansarullah have imposed.
Yeah. Zafar, in closing part of it, I was just going to ask you, I have been using an expression once in a while. It strikes me that what we have at the current moment is what I would call Khomeini time. The arrival of the Islamic Republic and their revolution, what shocked everybody was that there were two visitors, one from the Palestinians, Yasser Arafat, and then one from the South Africans. And Khomeini said, there are two colonial settler states in Africa. We won't have anything to do with either one of them because they're not founded on the democratic will of the people. And here we are with this current crisis, and it looks like this matter of who gets to rule the place is actually on the front burner.
Exactly. In fact, as we speak, in a couple of weeks' time, it would be the 45th anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution in Iran in February, basically. And so we see that what Imam Khomeini had said 45 years ago, as you mentioned, that the first visitors to Iran were Yasser Arafat and from South Africa, because the African National Congress, while there, you know, Mandela was still in prison, but there were, you know, activities taking place. And Iran, of course, after the Islamic Revolution, provided full support to the African National Congress as well as to the Palestinian people for their struggle against these colonial occupiers. And so it's a very important moment in world history.
Absolutely. We have the leader of the Likud and of Israel, Mr. Netanyahu, and he says, no, there's only going to be one state. The problem for him is that he may be right in a way he didn't expect.
Exactly, because you see, when it comes to this issue of two-state solution, that is no longer tenable because of the number of settlements that Israel has implanted in the West Bank, and there are more than 600,000 settlers in the West Bank, although some of them have fled now because of the war. And so, as you said, perhaps Netanyahu himself has paved the way for a single state in Palestine. I mean, it's all the people. I mean, this is something that the Palestinians have repeated.
It's his position.
Exactly, that they've always said that a single state in Palestine, where all people, whether it's Palestinians, whether they are Christians or Muslims, Jews, they will live in this that state as equal citizens under the law. We don't want any discrimination against anybody. And so, because at the present time, Israel is basically an apartheid state. It horribly mistreats the Palestinian people. They're attacking and killing Palestinians in Gaza, but they're also more than several hundred Palestinians have been killed in the West Bank. Thousands have been arrested and imprisoned and horribly tortured, etc. So basically, when Netanyahu says, and of course he doesn't mean it, but when he says that there is not going to be two states, so he's actually endorsing what the Palestinians have been saying, that there will be one state in which all people would be equal under the law.
Yes. Yeah, certainly, I mean, that the fact is that the commitment to the concept of self-determination doesn't match up with the old colonial formula. You cannot dictate and say, well, you can live here, but we keep the guns and you don't get to have any. It doesn't work that way.
Exactly.
Well, Zafar Ben-Gash, what a pleasure to talk to you. You've covered so much ground for us. We look forward to talking to you very soon about all these same matters, because the fire is not going out.
You are right.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Phil, for the opportunity. My great pleasure.
All right. Thank you. This is Data Report.